Good evening, everyone. It's a great joy to see you all again for our fourth and not quite last evening together. As most of you know, I'm visiting from the community that my husband and I run for Ananda in California. I've been in India, this is now 7 weeks, one more week at Pune, and then I go back. And it's been my extraordinary joy to travel around and to share Master's teachings with many great souls, including all of you. Tonight, our topic is how to keep spiritually focused in the midst of daily duties. I've had the idea to start in an unlikely place, so let's see if it works out. Why don't we bring it up to here? I'm going to start by making this chart. This is about the subject of time, because time is, of course, an issue when we're talking about spiritual life and everything. What I'm going to say about this is that for many, many years, I would hear Swamiji say, and I would read in many spiritual books, that time is an illusion, that past, present, and future are all happening at the same time. I would hear Swamiji say this with the conviction of his realization, and I would listen intently, thinking that this time I'm going to understand it. And I heard him say it hundreds of times, probably over the course of many decades. I never had the slightest idea what he was actually saying. I heard him tell the story of when he was a child. I think I mentioned it in here, that when he was a child, when he would lie down to go to sleep at night, a bright light would appear in front of his closed eyes. And as a child, that light would expand and expand, and then he would merge into that light. And he thought that's how everyone went to sleep. And it was many, many years in his life before he realized that this was not how everyone else went to sleep. Later, he said, he's told that story repeatedly, but one time he said something else in a different context entirely. He said later, when he came to Master and became Master's disciple, when he was 22 and he learned Kriya, and he learned to meditate, and he went into a state of superconsciousness, he recognized it as exactly the state that he had entered every night in his childhood. And he said when he entered that superconscious state, it was exactly the same moment that it had been in his childhood, because in superconsciousness there's no time. Well, I was fascinated by that and understood it not at all. Most recently, Swamiji has written a book which is published here now called The Time Tunnel. And it's really a story about two young boys, himself and his brother, but it's a fictional account. Well, let me phrase it differently. The author is silent on the point as whether it's fiction or fact. But nonetheless, these boys have an adventure and they're able to go backwards and forwards in time. Because this book is written for a more youthful audience, Swamiji has tried to simplify some of the concepts down. And when he was trying to explain about the illusion of time for the first time, because he was talking to 13-year-olds, suddenly I understood it. I suggested he write the Gita commentary, the Patanjali commentary, all the rest of them for adolescents, and maybe we'll all be able to understand. But this is the picture, and it actually is going to relate exactly to our topic, although this is a rather esoteric beginning, of how I've come to understand how eternity is always there, eternity is always the same, and past, present, and future are arrayed around it. And the picture looks really simple. It looks like this. There you are. Okay. This is the circle of reality. This is past, present, and future in an ever expanding reality, and maybe we live here. Maybe this is us, one individual, let's say, just in the particular place that they've been, all the past incarnations, all the future incarnations. Now, because we live and are identified and perceived, do we have a problem?
We're getting a better pen.
Oh, okay. Which one is better? But that one is a lousy one. That's the only thing we know, huh? Okay, the black one doesn't have a top on it, and therefore it might be dried up, but let's see what it does. There's black. Okay. Because we're living right here, and we're identified with the spot that we're in, it's pretty obvious that we don't have much of a perspective on the rest of it, do we? So it seems obvious to us that where we are now is the reality that we live in. Now, what Swamiji explained in the time tunnel is that past, present, and future are a circle around the center point of the eternal now, and that they're all radiating at all times from this point. So what I realized, and this helps a little, is when you're, the more deeply we are identified with the individual incarnation that we're in, the more tightly we cling to the rim of this wheel. This afternoon I was remembering a dear friend of ours, a woman named Bella, had a genetic predisposition to cancer. Her mother died early. She died young. Her sister died young. And when she was in the last, literally, few days of her life, she knew that there was no hope for her, so she stopped taking any treatment, and she was just simply lying at home, waiting for the last bit of life to pass out of her. And she was in an altered state. She was lying very contemplatively, and a friend was with her. And when Bella came back to some awareness of the world around her, she turned to her friend and she said, "As I lie here," she said, "I see thousands of faces that just keep going by in front of me. And I realize that every single one of them was my face in one incarnation or another." And then she realized how difficult it was then to be very deeply concerned about the face that she was about to lose. Having been in all those faces, it seemed like such a small matter to her to have this one go away. Well, if you think about it like that, all of these perspectives, all of the lifetimes in the past, and if you start thinking about Bhrighu and Agastya, and how thousands of years ago they were able to write predictive leaves about lifetimes that would happen thousands of years in the future, how could they possibly do this? So Swami says this is a circle around the center point, this is even worse, of the eternal now. Of the eternal now. And this is what I began to see, really simply. The more deeply we identify with this one incarnation, the more tight we are on the rim. As that identification begins to expand even a little, we tend to think of these things as total. Either we're in the material or the spiritual world. We're in the present or we're in eternity. But one of the most important words that Swami Kriyananda has added to spiritual vocabulary is the word directional. That spiritual life is not absolute. It's a question simply of which way we are facing and how we move gradually toward it. We don't get from base camp to the top of Everest just by sitting in base camp and then one day there we are. We have to climb every step of that way. And every step we take, we get higher in our point of view, literally an altitude if you're climbing the mountain, but in expanded awareness if we're talking of spirituality. So we can be totally identified with this reality, or we can begin to move toward the center point of eternity. And as our perspective, let's say, is here, when our perspective is here, we can only see the slightest reality. But from here, all of a sudden, that's the perspective that we have. And even just in practical terms, if you think about it. Well, for example, in the place where I live, which is an apartment complex that we lease, that we turned into our community. That's how we made a community without having to build or buy one. And when we first moved in, some of the people who lived there at the time that we leased it were still in residence, and their consciousness was not as elevated as the people from Ananda who are coming into it. And early one morning, this might not seem as odd for you in India where noise is more ubiquitous. In America, people tend to live more quietly. This our bedroom window was right
virtually on the driveway. This man was working on his car. He pulled his car up so that his car was about as close to me as the first row of people are here. I'm sleeping in my bed. He lifts the hood, then he turns on the radio, just about as loud as he could turn it on. It was Saturday morning. It was 6 a.m. on Saturday morning. And he's just there doing this as if he was the only person on the planet, and that is as if his actions had no consequences whatsoever. And I, no, there was no point in even being irate. It was just so preposterous. But I thought to myself, this man has so little consciousness of anything except his immediate reality that tomorrow or the next day, when somebody behaves toward him with absolute lack of consideration, he's going to be shocked. You know, he's not going to have any awareness of his present reality and the future, how his present is going to make the future. He probably has very little reality of how his present was formed by his past. Now, as we disidentify, even slightly, with who we are right now and move directionally toward eternity, we get a bigger perspective on both of these, don't we? We begin to understand the forces that made us who we are. We begin to gain a little more understanding of how we can influence the future. You know, the choices I'm making now have consequences, and those consequences will result in, we're not Bhrigu by any means. We're not able to talk about our incarnations 5,000 years hence, but we can have some idea of how today will create tomorrow. So we are, to that extent, you see, moving into a zone that is less ruled by time. And as we keep expanding our awareness and identifying with a greater reality that is our non-physical reality, which is to say the eternal consciousness which animates us, what I love about the way Swami teaches is that the idea of living in the eternal now, in which past, present, and future are equal, you can actually see how we would get there. We're still tied in this point of view to this one body, where it came from, where it's going, what it wants, what it likes, what it doesn't like. But the farther we move into identifying with the power of the spirit that flows through us, even the idea that we might have had many incarnations before, the whole discussion we had last night about karma, the night before about the chakras, just all these different ideas, you see what they do step by step is they redefine our own reality. We are no longer just a physical body moving through, having marriage or not marriage, wearing these clothes, being of this age, all of these things. We become a magnetic field. We become the pattern in our chakras. We become the force that influences that pattern. We become the manifestation of that pattern. We become the body moving in and out of the astral world and then reincarnating. Like my friend Bella in the last week of her life, all these thousands of faces have been me. And what am I going to do? I'm going to just tell you, and this is a little bit of gallows humor, but it's good to know how we can be detached from these things. About a week before she died, my friend was visiting her, and you know, Bella at that point was still fully conscious and fully herself, and my friend, just making chit-chat, looked at her and said, "Your hair looks really cute like that." You know, it was sort of short and like that. And Bella sort of looked at her for a moment and said, "I'm going to be the cutest little corpse you ever saw," is what she said, just like that. And that sounds morbid if you're clinging, but it sounds delightful if you're not, because her perspective had moved farther and farther away from here, and it didn't matter. So in our lives, as we begin to see ourselves, you know, less in terms of the birth and death of this one body and all its attachments and definitions, and more in terms of this force that's emanating from that, you see how our perspective gets bigger and bigger. And in fact, even our intuition, we begin to understand. We meet someone and we just know that we've known them before, and it doesn't even strike us as odd to think about that. Of course we've known each other before. This is not our first meeting.
There's a familiarity with people. In the context of the Ananda spiritual family, it's so common it's hardly even worth commenting on. You just, oh, there you are again. It's just so easy and natural because we're living as disciples of a great master. Here's my spiritual family. Who knows when we were together? And you go places, and when I went to pilgrimage to Badrinath, and we stopped at Josimath, and there's the ashram there that belonged to Adi Shankaracharya, the first Shankaracharya. There's the cave where he supposedly in that incarnation had his enlightenment. I never even heard of the place before. I walked onto that grounds, and the happiness I felt in that place was way out of proportion to anything rational. Later I heard Swami Kriyananda talking about the fact, in fact, when he started the Nayaswami order, one of the reasons he felt justified in doing it was he felt that Yogananda had been Adi Shankaracharya. He just proposed that that was likely. And all I said to him is, sir, when I went to his ashram, I felt like I'd been there and I'd been so happy there. What can you say? But when you're less committed here, then the past lives in the present, and you can anticipate your future on the basis of what you're doing. And like all things spiritual, you ask the question, how far can it go? I mean, that's one of the ways we begin to believe, even in self-realization itself. I mean, we can see how far it's gone so far, but we don't see any stopping point in front of us. So why can it? How far can awareness expand? How far detached? Let me phrase it differently. How much larger an identification is possible? And because that's a better way than thinking about detached. And this is where I'm going to be coming into the topic that we're specifically talking about tonight. The word detachment is a confusing word, because how can we be detached? A woman asked me once, you know, in America where people find their own love matches, you know, people sort of sit around and dream about, will I ever meet my husband? Will I ever meet my wife? And a woman asked me a question, and she's older than most women. Most women are married by the age that she is, and she's feeling a little bit, will I ever find, you know, the man that I will be happy living the rest of my life with? And being a devotee, she's sort of trying to work with that desire, since God isn't fulfilling it. She's trying to find a way to be happy, even if he doesn't. So she said to me, How can I come to understand that human love is just a distraction and that I really should just live for the love of God? And I looked at her and I said, never, that's not how you feel at all, is it? I said, why would you even, you're trying to push yourself into some mold that isn't really real for you. I said, you don't believe that. You deeply believe in your heart that you'll be happier if you find a man in your life. So what we have to do is not cut off these pieces. We just have to identify with a greater and greater reality. Instead of trying to detach ourselves from what is right now, I find it more dynamic, let me put it that way, to just leave it right where it is, but make a bigger world around it. So in her particular case, so maybe you'll be single for the rest of your life, even though you don't want to be. But what you need to do is just make a bigger and bigger sense of yourself around it. Your unhappiness comes because you have defined yourself by one little reality that in this particular case doesn't even exist. So you feel this terrible lack. So this is what we're doing. We're not so much detaching from this as we're identifying with more. And we're not specifically identifying with all of our past incarnations necessarily in detail, or making a list of all the places we're going to incarnate in the future necessarily, but we're recognizing that this is just an energy flow, an energy pattern that is presently vibrating in this certain way, but all of these other vibrations are also literally happening at the same time, in the sense that this energy pattern is connected to all of those flows, you see? We could never be who we are right now If it weren't for all that happened in the past to bring us here, we could never be who we're going to be in the future, except for all that cumulative reality. Now, that's kind of a little bit of a cheaty way to say that past, present, and future exist at the same time, but that's also a way of understanding it. It's all vibrating simultaneously because there's no divisions. There's no place where the ring breaks. I think it was a Buddhist monk who was asked about reincarnation. He said, the problem is you think of each incarnation as a separate event. He said, there's no break in consciousness. You step out of the body, your consciousness never disappears. It's just, we're in this room now, we're going to walk out and be in another room. You know, we'll all go home, we'll go to sleep, we'll wake up. There's no point at which we cease to be. It's all one continuous flow, and all of it is dependent on itself. And all of it is creating the next reality. So we move into a greater and greater state of awareness of the truth of what we're experiencing until we stand at the center. And then, of course, like the hub of any wheel, every spoke is equidistant from the center. And from that perspective, we can look everywhere. Swami, as a little child, entered into the eternal now. Swamiji, as a disciple of a great master, entered into the eternal now. And when he was standing here, you see all the lines converge. And he realized he was standing in his consciousness. He wasn't standing at all. But in his consciousness, he was exactly where he had been here. And no time had passed because there was no distance of any kind between those points. Now, I love that. I hope you like that. This took me so many years to get even close to. But this is how it relates to our everyday life, which is what we're really talking about. One of the things, when I was reflecting on this afternoon, I realized that this question, how to be spiritually focused in everyday life, could be rephrased as the question is, why did Paramahansa Yogananda incarnate at this particular time? What is the purpose of his incarnation? What is the essence of self-realization as Yogananda brought it to the world at this time? You know, avatars don't just sort of randomly incarnate. I mean, there's always a powerful divine reason, because avatars shift the energy of the planet on which they live. And they very often come at times when world culture is going, the planetary is going through some shift. Not always, but often. Krishna came at the point at which Dwapara Yuga was ending and Kali Yuga was starting. And that's why, as you all know in the story of the Mahabharata, he urged upon these otherwise righteous people unrighteous actions. Because he said, Kali Yuga is coming, and evil is just too strong, and we can't live the way we've lived until now. And Krishna himself did things that were considered shocking at the time. But he was changing the Yuga. Sri Yukteswar has told us, even though not everyone historically agrees, but Sri Yukteswar has told us that we are exactly at the same point of shift on the planet now as we were when Krishna was there, to turn this into something else. If this is the nadir of the Yuga cycle, where Kali Yuga descending meets Kali Yuga ascending, Krishna came when Dwapara Yuga turned into Kali, Yogananda has come when Kali turns back into Dwapara Yuga. So they're exactly the same in this direction, but we're going two different ways. The characteristic of Kali Yuga is that it's the age of matter, and material things, as we were talking about the chakras, not all of you were here, but we were talking about the earth chakra. The nature of the material world is that things assume a shape and those shapes seem to divide. You take two physical objects and you wrap them against each other and they both hold their shape. And from that comes the belief that I am separate from you, that I am my physical body, that the form of things is the reality of things. That's the great delusion of Kali Yuga, is that form is the same as truth. And from Kali Yuga comes dogmatic, institutionalized religion. Because the form of things, people feel that's how it has to be expressed. It has to have a material form, and the more exact that material form is, the closer it is to the truth. That's why cathedrals were built so huge, because God is, after all, rather big. So we needed to sort of give the impression of how big God is and how little we are by comparison, because they didn't have any other way of getting that thought across in Kali Yuga except by material form. Right now, it will only be relevant to a few of you, but you know the Pope has resigned, so right now the Catholic Church does not have a leader. The first time I went to the Vatican, all I could say, just sort of like an idiot, was, "Wow, it's so big." Just over and over, "Wow, it's so big." And it was just like everything about that delusion of physical power equals spiritual power is just completely epitomized there. Now, in Dwapara Yuga, what we're understanding is that energy is the reality. That's what Dwapara is, the age of energy. And if you look at the last 100 years, you see what the shift has been, is this extraordinary explosion of a more subtle understanding of energy. And we tend to think that people have invented things, but they haven't invented energy. They have invented ways of tapping into that energy. And that energy was always there to be tapped into, but during Kali Yuga, planetary consciousness just wasn't elevated enough for anybody to see it, except a random individual here or there who was way ahead of his time. I mean, I'm here because I got on that airplane, and I got on the airplane in San Francisco, and it was close to the eternal now, you know, going across on the airplane, but nonetheless, in a relatively short period of time, here I am. I mean, who could have done that before? Even when Swami Kriyananda was a child, when he wanted to go, when their family went from Europe to America, they got on a ship, which in itself was an extraordinary thing. But, you know, it took them a couple of weeks to travel half the distance. And now, in the course literally of one 24-hour period, we just crossed the globe. We're way on the other side because of the fuel, because of the computer systems on the plane. I don't have to elucidate it. But the nature of energy, and especially the revelations that have come right now, is to talk to us about how the form of things is quite mutable. Because everything is, as Einstein declared for us, that matter appears to be solid, but in reality, it is just energy vibrating in a certain way. And that energy can be shifted. I mean, it's all the same substance. So even though we still live in this world in which two physical things seem separate from each other, we just somehow have begun to know, because it's arising yuga, that it's really the energy of things that matter, not the form of them. Yogananda came in to usher that truth in, and he did it in a very, you know, many, many dynamic ways, including teaching us literally what he called the energization exercises, so that we could have access to infinite energy, each one of us individually, by the exercise of our will. We just sort of learn those exercises without stopping and thinking, what a revelation that is, what a revolution that is, that energy is infinite, and by a concentrated act of will, we can access infinite energy. I mean, such an idea couldn't even have been spoken in Kali Yuga. Nobody would know what you were talking about. Even when the machines were invented, they were all defined in terms of horsepower, which is a phrase that we still use. Oh, the engine has 100 horsepower. Does anyone know how much one horsepower is? But when they invented the machines, they tried to explain that, well, this machine has the equivalent power of 3 of your horses. Oh, I understand that. It's the only way they could think about it. It's a remnant that has long since been proved inaccurate, but that was the only way that the shift could be made. The other reality that Yogananda brought, another reality, he brought many, is that he defined spirituality as an inner experience of our own consciousness. That's why he called his work in America self-realization. Self-realization, that's what he called it. He didn't call it the first church of this or another, or he didn't name it after any particular practice. Self-realization is what he called it, which means the whole teaching is our own experience. And then he went further than that. He gave us energization exercises where, in this extraordinarily democratic, egalitarian way, every individual in the universe can have equal access to infinite energy. When you really think about how much of Kali Yuga was based on people with power holding on to that power and making it more and more difficult for anybody else to have that power, however that power was defined, whether it was the king and the serfs, or the priest and his congregation, or the rituals and the necessity to do them and those who didn't know how to do them, all of those different aspects, those with power would hold the power and then distribute it. If they were generous-hearted, they would distribute it for the benefit. If they were corrupt, they would hold on to it and distribute it only for their own benefit. Then Yogananda comes. I mean, and that's how the churches were organized, too. Hinduism is kinder in its essential nature, but nonetheless, you have to hire a pujari to do the ritual for you. At least that's how it was explained to me. One of my Indian friends said, it's the only religion in the world that you have to pay someone else to do for you, because only a few people know and they have to make their living. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but you do not have direct access to it. It takes a trained intermediary, an authorized intermediary, however you put that. The Catholic Church, the priest has to absolve you. You have to go to the confession. If you die without the last rites, it's all the power is in the hands of someone else, or the dogmas that you have to follow, however you describe it. Master said, the only place God can be worshipped is in the human nervous system. I find that juxtaposition of words as a writer extremely awkward. The word human nervous system after the only place God can be worshipped always just makes me think, wasn't there a better way to say it? But nonetheless, it is just a sort of a startling statement, isn't it? But what about the temple? But what about the priest? But what about the dogma? What about qualifying? He said the only place, in other words, is within our own selves. And then he brought the teaching of Kriya Yoga, which Babaji gave to Lahiri. Lahiri passed to Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar passed it to Master. Master put it in a set of written lessons that you could get through the mail. You had to order them. You had to qualify. You had to manage to meet a few standards. It wasn't like he was being at all irresponsible. But anybody who could read, or even if you couldn't read, you could have Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga gives us access to infinite consciousness. It gives us access to God. And what that also does is not only opens the doors in the sense of removing the institutional intermediaries or the priestly intermediaries, but it also puts absolute responsibility right in the hands of the individual. I mean, there's the positive and there's the negative. It used to be that you could belong to the right church, adhere to the right dogmas, pay the right fees, and be guaranteed of your place in heaven. You just didn't have to worry. You just followed these rules. An American comedian said, to imagine that you could become a Christian by sitting in a church, he said, is like sitting in your garage waiting to become a car. There's about as much logic to it. But very, very recently, people believe if you just sit in the right church, that makes you a godly person. Yogananda exploded that myth. absolutely exploded it. And it's gradually, he's responding to the times and he's creating the consciousness of the times both. This is what an avatar does. Every avatar is equal in his infinite consciousness, equally free, equally vast, but when they come to incarnate or sent by the divine, however the system works, I don't really know, but when they are living amongst us, they become limited by the culture in which they've incarnated, the yuga on the planet, the mission that they have to carry out. And so what they offer us is defined by what is appropriate for the times. So what Yogananda offers us is perfectly appropriate for moving from Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga, in which form is dissolving and actual consciousness is taking its place. Now, that's why I started here, because this is what this is about. This is not about the form of what we're doing. It's learning to identify with a greater and greater reality, even though we still have our spoke still comes right to this point, and from wherever we are on this spectrum, even in infinity, we may still be responsible and we still may be expressing in this world through this point. It's a question of how we define ourselves. Swami Kriyananda has a physical body. Yogananda had a physical body. They did many, 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 many things with the dot in the span of past, present, and future. But they did it from the perspective here. And we live either from here or here or here or here, however we manage to do it. But specifically, what our assignment is, having been born at this particular transition, Kali Yuga, moving into early Dwapara Yuga, and finding ourselves in relationship to these masters, at which time the message has been honed to a very sharp focus, is this whole idea that there are different forms and that the forms somehow dictate our consciousness is the fundamental illusion that we're trying to take away. And we're trapped a little bit in this transition because even though some of you have been born since Dwapara Yuga proper really was launched, you know, but nonetheless, the influence of Kali Yuga is still really strong on all of us. And we're still constantly hypnotized by this idea that form dictates consciousness instead of understanding that consciousness defines form. Yesterday when I was asked a very good question by a gentleman here about keeping the right consciousness at work, I was talking about the fact that, and I find this, I reflected on this a lot, I said it last night, but it just came out of my mouth and only today did I really think about what I'd said. When Swami Kriyananda first arrived in this country for this cycle in 2003, he immediately began to do an enormous amount of tapasya through his body, which he has often done. He often uses that body to help work out various kinds of karma. And in fact, and so he was in and out of the hospital. He had double pneumonia at one point. I was visiting here once, and he was in the hospital, and a sadhu that I'd never have seen before or since somehow heard that he was there and came to see him. And that sadhu expressed some concern about Swami's being in the hospital. Swami laughed quite merrily and said, "Oh, I'm just doing tapasya to establish the work in India." Then the two men chuckled together, and then they just went on with whatever else they were doing. And just very casually, you know, even if you're animating this dot, when you're identified with the whole, you just use this dot in the way it needs to be used. Great yogis can use their bodies in ways that we can not understand and barely imagine. But I was talking about the karmic boomerangs that come Well, the high souls who are have a completely different relationship with their body can draw all kinds of energy and run it through their physical bodies. Master said that high souls can take on karma without it necessarily affecting their physical body, but sometimes they choose to have it affect their physical body. After that, I don't know anything about it, but it's fascinating. But when Swami Kriyananda was in the hospital with one of those cycles, that was when he had double pneumonia, and he came really close to leaving the body, or he appeared to come close to leaving the body at that point. And he was sick in the hospital, and many of you have heard him tell this story, and he was barely conscious and barely functioning, and a doctor came in and said, "Sir, can you help me?" And Swamiji thought that he was hardly the picture of anything worth, you know, asking advice from, but nonetheless the doctor asked, and because Swamiji lives to serve others, he said, "What can I do for you?" The man said, he explained that he had a son who was going to school in Canada. He had many expenses in his family. And he confessed that it was not always possible to be completely honorable, honest in his work because of the necessity to draw money. And Swamiji very compassionately understood, you know, what the man was up against. But after that, I mean, within hours after that, even though he was not well at all, Keshava was living here at the time. He invited Keshava into his hospital room, and he just started dictating the course that became material success and happiness through yogic principles. I subsequently gave a long verbal class based on that material, which I called Manifesting Through the Power of Yoga, just in case you want to go to my website to find it. And he spent almost a year writing 26 lessons in which he delineated the relationship between spiritual power and material success. And when I was talking about it yesterday, I emphasized the point that we think the material universe is the most powerful universe because we ourselves are trapped in it and it seems to define our reality. But anyone who has moved even slightly above it, and the fact of the matter is anyone in this material world who has any real success that is generated in the moment, it's because one way or another, he or she has stumbled upon the secrets of how to concentrate and direct energy. That's how success is made, is by being able to concentrate energy, by being able to generate magnetism, and somewhere or another to tap into this infinite supply of energy and direct it toward whatever that objective is, whether it's the objective of manifesting money, manifesting projects, whatever it might be. People of real success have found these universal laws. That's why many people who are highly successful in one field can easily shift over and be highly successful in another, because they know the principles of drawing energy and then directing that energy. This is manifesting material success and happiness through yogic principles, that the spiritual world is more powerful than the material world. The material world is a tiny little manifestation from that spiritual realm. And all the success that we seek in life does not come from pounding at all the pieces. It comes when we're sitting right here. It's very hard to generate success because we have so little to work with. But if we move closer to the spiritual source, just look how much more we have. We understand where we came from. We understand where we are now. We understand where we're going. And by definition, we would also understand how to get there. And if we're talking about our material life and how to live it, that's what we're talking about. How are we going to get in this world from where we are now to where we're going? Now, Yogananda, let me just finish about this. So the first thing that Swami Kriyananda did in India was write that course to reintegrate people's understanding of the material and the spiritual world, and reintegrate it in a success-oriented way, not a sort of pious sitting in the forest ashram you know, doing puja sort of way, but a metropolitan mall, you know, building a new society along completely new line sort of way. If you want to be successful in what you're doing in the world, spirit is the answer. And yesterday it occurred to me, and that's what I also said, that I think that's the mission of India. I mean, I would be presumptuous to declare it, but to become as wealthy as this culture once was, but to do so by not only by the methods of Dharma, which is self-evident, but by the understanding that has always characterized this culture, that the only reality is the spiritual reality, and that the spirit, the material world, is ruled by the spiritual world. It's knowledge that has been obliterated and confused by Kali Yuga, but now is the time for it to come forward again. And this is precisely Yogananda's message. He's not telling us that wealth is the answer, but I think it's very interesting that his most advanced male disciple and his second most advanced male disciple were both self-made American millionaires. Self-made American millionaires. Not people who just were born to wealth, but who generated that kind of wealth. Odd, in a real sense, because why? But I think it was partly just because this is what the world needs right now, is to integrate these two realities instead of having them divided up in our own minds. And so even in this room, someone says, I have to work all these hours every day. You know, my spiritual life and my material life are two different things. But how could they possibly be two different things when you really stop and think about it? I mean, where does your consciousness go while you're at work? When do you cease being a child of God merely because you've checked into the office? You know, where do you leave your soul? Where do you leave your divine aspiration? And so what we're working with at all times, and this is what Yogananda is telling us, is that we're always working with the fact that the responsibility for our consciousness is right in our own hands. And we've taken that responsibility from us in a spiritual sense away from dogmas and priests and institutions, but we also have to take it back from the office and from the bank or whatever, wherever it is that we're working, or from the drudgery of housework or wherever it is that we're working. We have gotten the thought in our mind that form dictates consciousness, that the material world has power over the spiritual world. And that's 100% what Yogananda came to burst apart, to have us understand infinite energy is accessible to every one of us. Self-realization is in our own hands if we choose to use it. So the first thing about how to remain spiritually focused in our work life is to realize there's no such thing as work life and spiritual life. There's just life. That's all. There's just life. I learned this to a very large extent really vividly from my husband, who I had my life really divided up in lots of different pieces, spiritual, not spiritual, and so on. He's a hard-working man, and to him, everything was always just energy. And he would be sort of bewildered by this sort of fragmented universe that I lived in. Whatever job it was that was given him to do, it was the same job. You just get up in the morning, you look at it, you say, how can this best be performed? And best means not only, of course, not just merely external conditions, but best means how can I best do this? How can I be my best self in this situation? How can I live according to my highest principles? How can I continue in this situation to be a channel for the divine energy that is the entire reality of who I am? In other words, where is my consciousness? The only question, where is my consciousness? Now, if we are entirely identified with this one little tiny dot, and we're thinking only of today in the office and what the boss said yesterday and what's going to happen tomorrow, which is an easy pit to get sucked down into, there's a lot of the world that thinks that way, and those thoughts are vibrating all around us, and we get sucked into them all the time, which incidentally is why Master also called it Self-Realization Fellowship. In India, you go to satsanga, because we need each other right now. It's too chaotic a time. The sucking power of Kali Yuga is still too great. We need to reinforce each other's understanding of these principles, because you go into a world where nobody else feels that any of this is true. And it's, if you, as Ramakrishna said, if you peel onions, your hands will smell like onions. And if you live in if you spend time only with people who have a deeply materialistic view of life, it's very hard to remember that they're completely wrong. No matter, because some of them are successful and powerful and even have power over you. But all that we're ever doing in our lives is trying to identify more and more with eternity and less with this reality. But what's so interesting, you see, is the ones who identify most completely with eternity are the most effective. I mean, Paramahansa Yogananda is transforming a whole society. Jesus Christ, Krishna, they changed the planet forever, this line of masters. Swami Kriyananda, yesterday I mentioned to you, for circumstances beyond his control, at the age of 36, after being 14 years a monk, he was out of the monastery, absolutely alone, exiled from the only people he knew in the world, all his friends, all his supporters, all his acquaintances, totally exiled from them, without a penny. Nothing. He had nothing. He was sleeping in the back bedroom, as he said, of his parents' house, staring at the ceiling, wondering what his life was about. And then just out of his own consciousness, his own connection to the divine, his own discipleship to the guru, his own self-realization, he's created this worldwide movement that is Ananda, that just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding, because the spiritual rules the material. And on a absolutely day-to-day basis, the way to live in the world is to say, you know, how can I solve this material problem from the level of consciousness? And realizing that if the consciousness is right, everything else follows from that. And the fun of that is, you see, it makes your life so much more interesting. And whatever it is that you're dealing with, not only will you in the end be far more effective, because where there is dharma, there is always victory. Where there is attunement, there is inspiration, there is intuition, there is magnetism. You won't necessarily succeed in places where, you know, the Kali Yuga force is too terrible. I'm not saying that your success will be effortless. But if we always ask first, what is the right consciousness? What is the right magnetism? How can I generate? Let me just shift over to one more thought here. There's a cartoon that I saw, and it was from the New York. It was like a thoughtful cartoon, not a funny cartoon. And it was about Einstein's declaration that matter is really only a vibration of energy. And it was a quote from Einstein, and it said, mankind will have to gradually accustom himself to an energy concept of the universe. In other words, breaking from Kali Yuga to Dwapara, although Einstein didn't know those words. And then the picture is all these different people, like a man who was sweeping the streets, and then he's pausing, leaning thoughtfully on his broom. There's a woman who was out shopping, and you can see her. She's not really looking at the things in the window, but she's thinking like this. The cab driver has stopped his cab. Everybody is gradually accustoming himself to an energy concept of the universe. But in fact, it's a very, very interesting point, because once we begin to recognize that it is not a material world, but is in fact vibrations of energy, we realize that what influences matter is the quality and the quantity of the energy. And so even when we're faced with a very difficult material problem, when we stop and think about this, we realize that magnetism is the key to this solution, not horsepower. It's in Kali Yuga, the only force we had was physical force. But now that we're working with energy, it's magnetism. And what is magnetism? Magnetism is the quality of our consciousness. That most advanced disciple of Yogananda's, his name was James J. Lin. Yogananda called him Rajasi Janakananda. That was the name he gave him. Rajasi used to meditate all morning and didn't go into the office until noon. Of course, he was the president and founder of the company, so he could get away with that. People would say to him, with all your business responsibilities, how can you afford to wait until 12 o'clock to go into the office? He said, with all my business responsibilities, I can't afford not to. Because he knew if he was deeply aligned with the divine force, and now I'm just talking about sadhana, but then when he went into the office with that connection, his magnetism would both influence others in the right way, and they talked about in these articles written by the local paper where he lived, who they really know almost nothing about his spiritual life. He kept it hidden for family reasons and also for business reasons. But everybody, they just talked about the remarkable influence that he had on people and how often people, without him even asking, would try to conform themselves to his wishes. It was because of the divine love that he emanated. It was because of the clarity of his wisdom. It was because the absolute integrity of his vibration. It's an energy universe, and when he was vibrating in those ways, the very molecules of physical things had to adjust just to match his consciousness. Swami Kriyananda once said to me, because I tended to overwork in such a way that tension would come into my efforts. And Swamiji said to me once, you don't necessarily do more good by doing more. You may do more, but you don't do more good. And what I really understood when I captured that was that if my magnetism is off, everything is off. And that magnetism can be that you just grow impatient with people, that you want to overcome them with your will, that you actually really dislike what you're doing and you're crabby about it. And in my own life, I gradually learned that as soon as my magnetism went off, whatever was required to bring it back into center was more important than just keeping on doing what I was doing, because in an energy universe, wrong magnetism will never bring right result. Now, in our work lives, if you don't have a lot of freedom of coming and going, sometimes we have to learn to be able to generate the right magnetism even in the moment. But if we integrate into our work life this simple awareness that if I compromise the laws of divine magnetism, nothing that I'm trying to accomplish will really come out as well as I think it will. But if in the moment I go off into the restroom and just pull my energy back to the spiritual eye, pray to the masters to help me. A friend of mine always kept an empty chair in his desk, in his office, in a position that it was not convenient for anyone else to sit in. So it looked like it was just a chair in his office, but no one would ever sit in it because it wasn't well placed. Because he was deeply devoted to Jesus, and in his mind, Jesus was always in that chair. And whenever he would have some business, and he was a very successful businessman, I will add, and whenever he would have some difficulty, he would just sort of cast his eyes over to that chair. It seemed like a perfectly natural thing to the people in his office. He was just thinking like this. But he wasn't just thinking. He was asking Jesus to help him in that circumstance. What can I do? How can I do this? You know, I found a method and that's actually really helped me a lot also. Swamiji expressed it to me. When you're having to work with people who are difficult, you know, all of us have the same divinity within us. It's an amazing thing to contemplate. I was with Swami Kriyananda once at Disneyland. And he used to really like Disneyland. Disneyland has gotten a lot more worldly, so he doesn't enjoy it as much. But in the early years when we would go, it was much more innocent. And he was very strong in those days, and he would walk really fast, and he knew just where he wanted to go in the whole park. And there were like about 14 of us with him that day. And he was always in the lead, and we were always running behind him, sometimes literally holding hands so we wouldn't lose each other, running behind him, just like little children. It was really quite an amazing day. And at 6 o'clock, or whenever sunset comes at Disneyland, they had the electric parade. And the electric parade is floats. Many of you may have seen it or seen it on television. People in costumes wearing twinkle lights, like the lights we have around here sometimes. It was really beautiful and fun, and the music was really sweet then. Now it's not, but it was really sweet then. And so we wanted to have a good seat for the parade. So about a half an hour before, all 14 of us went and were sitting. First, we were standing on the sidewalk right in our spot. And all of a sudden, Swami he shifted, as he's inclined to do, into a completely different bhav, and we're looking around Disneyland. You know, we could see hundreds of people from where we were standing. And he said to us, imagine, not merely loving all these people, but actually being all these people. He said that was the consciousness of Master. Master stands in the center and all of creation circles around him. I spoke to you earlier about how at the end of his life, Master sometimes couldn't keep walking. I'm in so many bodies, he said. I forget which one I'm supposed to keep moving. I have to ask others if I've eaten. So we're standing in Disneyland. Swami looks out at this, you know, and it's from many countries and people pushing babies and old people and young people. Imagine not merely loving all these people, but being all these people. Then the spiritual mood came out of him into all of us to such an extent that we all sat down on the sidewalk and just started meditating. And so we meditated for about half an hour or so, because when we came out of it, the electric parade was coming, and we realized that when we sat down, there was space, but this whole crowd of people had come around us, and you know, they were all just standing at this odd group, just meditating right there. But I've always remembered the feeling of that very deeply, and translating that into every single person you're working with, no matter how unpleasant or pleasant they might be, likable or unlikable, it isn't just a question of loving them. It's also a question of realizing that your consciousness is unified. You're the same reality. And no matter how diverse your objectives may appear and your methods of attaining them, we are all of us seeking the same bliss. Swamiji repeatedly tells us of the dream he had when he was in Florence a number of years ago, when he saw himself, just all the diverse people in the world, and realized every one of them, in their own way, is seeking bliss. That there's no difference. We think we have all these different objectives, but we're all in one unified project with one goal. And Swamiji said, how could you not love everyone? Because we're all working together to have the same experience. And I've often found sometimes when I've had difficulty with people, you can pray to Divine Mother to help you solve it. I mean, even if someone is right there in front of you, you can be looking right in their eyes and seemingly paying attention to what they're saying, but inside your heart you may be desperately praying, you know, God, Guru, Divine Mother, what am I going to do? How can I help? Astonishing things will come into your mind, especially if the prayer is, how can I help? How can I help this person? Maybe whatever we're trying to do, what we're all trying to do, you see, we're responsible for this dot, but move closer to eternity. You see, past and future, whatever's happening right now is so small compared to where we're really going. That doesn't mean we don't have to be utterly attentive to it. It's a false idea to think you can do it badly. You have to be utterly attentive to it, but in the context of what we're really doing. That prayer alone will bring astonishing results. And the other prayer I've found is, everybody's superconscious is also equally present, and the superconscious is that part of our own nature which links us to the infinite. And that superconscious is always being fed with exactly the right understanding of what the soul is supposed to do. We act from the ego, but really it's the superconscious that's guiding us, even if it's only sort of taking a back seat while the ego makes a hash of things. Nonetheless, the superconscious is waiting to nudge us forward or kick us forward toward the infinite. So I've also find it helpful to actually pray to the person that you're trying to work with. And you actually say, again, you don't say it out loud because you would get fired, so don't say it out loud. But just looking at them with whatever is appropriate in the moment, but you say, how can I help you? What are you trying to accomplish here? Could you tell me what it is that you want from me? And again, I've had astonishing intuitions come into my mind that I would never have imagined, because all of a sudden, what have we done? We've dissolved the distance between us. We've moved from Kali Yuga, in which we seem to be separate. We're moving into Dwapara Yuga, where consciousness unites. If you want to go back to this chart, it just works. We're spreading out. We're identifying with a greater reality. If we think of this circle, instead of being time, as just all the people in the world, we identify deeply with one, or we move closer to the center, and then all of a sudden our awareness moves out. If God has brought me into relationship with you, he must have a reason. And if you can think that, if you can't imagine what that reason is yourself, then ask him. Ask God or ask him or her who's in front of you. This is only slightly related, but I used to have trouble feeling I needed this huge amount of personal space, which, you know, you don't always get. And when I decided at one point that I really didn't need that anymore, God sent me a Croatian who was about 6.5 feet tall, who had absolutely no sense of personal space. Plus, he had a huge voice with an accent that made it difficult for me to understand him. And he seemed to have taken a special liking to me. So he would come and stand about here, except because he was so big, he would stand here like this, and he would lean over me and in a very loud voice, talk to me for long periods of time. And it became such an interesting exercise for me to just sort of say, what difference does it make? You know, a tremendous amount of what we think of for problems are not really problems. We just imagine that they're problems. He's not hurting me. You know, I'm not suffering. I'm not in pain. He's just talking to me, and it seems to please him to talk to me, so let him talk to me. Maybe it's a little louder than I would like, and maybe I would like him to stand back about 3 or 4 feet, but, you know. And also then just that feeling of, why am I always trying to define myself as separate? Why am I so deeply identified with my body that the mere fact that he's close to me and talking loudly into my ears is disturbing me? You see, everything can become so interesting. Everything can become just an interesting challenge to, why can't I find a solution to this? Why do I think this is a problem? And everything becomes about expanding our consciousness. I've had this simple realization in the process of writing that I used to struggle to make things come out a certain way, and sometimes I had a lot of trouble writing. Recently, I haven't had much trouble at all. But I'm a little embarrassed to say this. When it stops working, you just say, Master, why isn't this working? What do you want? And that just sounds like such a simple prayer, But I finally learned if it's not coming out right, it's because that's not what God wants. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're supposed to capitulate. It just means that you're not trying to accomplish your goal in the right way. In fact, Swami made the statement, Master made the statement, all failure is a lack of attunement with the divine. I had a little hard time understanding that, but when I began to sort of understand how to make the writing flow better, I realized if it wasn't working, it was because it wasn't what was trying to happen. And I just had to say to Master, okay, where are we trying to go? And if we make our work life just, if God is asking you to do it, he's probably keen on making it come out in a way that'll be helpful. Where are we trying to go? How are we going to get there? Look, sir, I'm trapped in this terrible, dull meeting, and nobody in this room has a single creative idea. What are we going to do? And you'll just be amazed, especially when you ask it not with this desperate sense of, oh, what an agonizing life I have, but this, like, well, here we are together. Remember an autobiography of a yogi? They just, I don't know why the story is told this way, but Master Mahashaya takes Yogananda as a young man. He takes them to watch these bioscope, these slides in some university, and they're very, very boring. And then Master Mahashaya whispers to Yogananda, Divine Mother is sympathetic with what's going on here. And in a moment, all the lights will go out, and when it turns dark, we'll be able to escape. And then just seconds later, inexplicably, the power goes out. Under the cover of darkness, they flee from the room. As soon as they're out of the room, the lights go on again. And they hear the professor saying, well, that was odd, the lights going out like that. But I think of that story sometime. Divine Mother is very sympathetic. And if we understand that there is no situation, no circumstance, no responsibility, no single instant of our entire existence ever in which God is not exactly fully present as he will ever be. Now, Kali Yuga tells us something else, but Master has given us this as our truth. And wherever you are, whenever you think, this is not a spiritual situation, this is not a time when I can think about God, you know, this is a curse put upon me, I wish I could get back to my temple, you have to realize that the only place God can be experienced or worshipped is the human nervous system. And if you've got one, God is there with you. Just break the delusion. This is our responsibility as well as our opportunity. Because we are Master's followers or his disciples, we are his children, wherever you stand on that spectrum, how does the consciousness of a master change the planet? Through the consciousness of those who wish to be his instruments. And the instrument is deeply blessed by that which flows through it. So, do we have any questions? Oh, you know what? I said last night, because at 5 of 9, this gentleman asked a question and I was completely stuck with it. The question was about karma, and it actually relates to this, so let me answer that. The question was, if karma is set and everything is the result of karma and somebody is suffering, maybe we shouldn't help them because it may be his karma to suffer and we don't want to interfere. When I spoke to him afterwards, his question was much more interesting and multi-textured than what I heard him say. So I'm not going to hold him responsible for the question. But yes, and he's grateful to be absolved. But nonetheless, it's a question that people often ask. And I realize that the answer to that question is exactly everything that I've talked about now, which is we cannot define right or wrong according to the material expression of it. Right or wrong is entirely our consciousness. And earlier, Swami, earlier meaning earlier in my discussions of bringing it up, I said that Swami was asked by a radio interviewer, you know, you seem to be closer to the end of your life. Are you a happy man? And Swamiji said, well, many people say they're happy. He said, I don't think that's an accurate question. He said, a person who has true joy, the real measure of happiness is the degree to which a person strives to make everyone as happy as he is. And in other words, that's the state of a master. A master is infinitely blissful, but is willing to incarnate in a physical body for the possibility of giving that bliss to others. That's a happy man. And Swami Kriyananda said about himself that, you know, he defines himself as a blissful person because his only purpose, his only reason for living is to give to others as much as he can of the bliss that he himself experiences. So when I was actually thinking of the question of how do you help someone or not, if your consciousness is where you want it to be, you want to share the bliss that you have with everyone, whether it's simply, you know, whether it's on a lesser level of happiness or comfort, whatever it is, but directionally toward bliss, whatever it might be, your consciousness will naturally want to share its uplifted nature with others. And then it's not a question of whose karma, this karma, that karma. It's your consciousness is where it needs to be. Now, in this country, where there are so many different levels of material existence happening simultaneously, it's not practical as an ideal to try to shift everybody's material condition. You know, you just can't do it. You would empty your pocketbook in the first 5 minutes, and then there, where would you be? Your family would then be impoverished too. There's just no way you can do it. The physical problems, I won't even just say this country, in the whole world, are just so great that we can't define the way we serve others as only whether or not we shift their material conditions. The way we serve is by giving to others as much as we can whatever happiness and joy we ourselves have been able to bring into our own consciousness. And the very measure of the validity and the divinity of that joy we feel is that the more divine the source of our joy, the more spontaneously and effortlessly and without question we want to share it. I've watched Swami Kriyananda for many years move through this world, and he relates as he feels intuitively guided to relate, but he doesn't shirk. He gives bliss wherever the bliss will be received. And sometimes it's just conversation. Sometimes it's material help. There was this man, we were somewhere in Europe, and this man came up to him and asked him for money. A beggar came up, but we were in Europe, so it was a sort of a different situation. And Swami looked at him, and he opened his wallet, but at the same time, it was a young man. He said, I'm going to give you a little bit of money, but not very much. You are a young, strong man, and you should be working. And then he gave him a little money. He said, but I'm not going to give you any more, just like that. A total stranger, but that was the way he needed to talk to him at that point. He talked to a taxi driver in Goa who was complaining about the Kashmiris who'd taken over all the handicraft shops and so on like that. He starts talking to him, which was his theme for the next time we were down there, about what kind of handicrafts do the Goan people have and why don't you be as industrious as the Kashmiris in developing them, you know? But it was all like, how can I help you? How can I help you? How can I help you? Because energy, creativity, the taxi driver was seeing himself as a victim of another cultural group, that's not going to help him. So Swamiji starts giving him solutions, you know, and that's how we live, because that's right for us to live that way. And where there is Dharma, there is always victory, and shift comes from magnetism. If we're just worried about other people and anxious about their karma and anxious about our karma, you know, we might be able to give them a bowl of soup, but you won't really shift their consciousness. So we work on our own consciousness. The nature of bliss is to want to share itself. And if we move through the world like this, you see what that also makes us, that makes us in tune with intuition. Because we don't always know what needs to be done. But if we are always asking God, how can I help? How can I help? Then also we don't have to ask abstract questions. Because what we are then is in tune and we become an instrument of that. Moving through India as a pilgrim, as a guide on pilgrimages over many years, as I did, the whole question, especially for Americans who feel like they have so much wealth sometimes compared to the people who are asking for it, who do we help and how do we help? I said, if you're sensitive, you'll always know who you should help. You know, you'll keep your purse closed, and then somebody will come up to you, and you just know this one belongs to you. And just then suddenly it's your turn to give, and you just know it. And it really is not about the material world. The spiritual world is in charge of the material world. Attune yourself on the spirit, and everything follows.
Ma'am, what about Reiki healing?
Say it again.
Reiki healing.
Reiki healing? What do you mean, in what respect? If this world being an energy universe, energy patterns can be, everything is mutable, everything is just a pattern of energy, energy is influenced by other energy. The greater magnetic force always influences the weaker magnetic force. So if an individual's magnetic commitment to a physical or a mental aberration is stronger than someone else's power to infuse that person with an alternate thought, no healing will take place, no matter how sincere. But if the healer has a stronger vibrational capacity to visualize and manifest attuned wellness, then the pattern can disappear. However, as soon as the person who has the illness moves away from that magnetism, they can remanifest it. So sometimes you're healed in the moment, but as soon as you get away from that magnetic field, your own will assert itself again. So it depends on many factors. So what is your question then?
My question was that, is it right to do that?
You know, of course it's right to try to help people. And if your particular interest is in helping them physically or mentally, of course it's right to do that. However, I read a very astute comment by a woman who had tremendous power to shift the pattern of other people's physical and mental selves. And she did that pretty regularly. And this is the story she told. There was a woman who had some kind of a fairly debilitating disease. And she cured her of that disease because she had enough power to do so. And then as soon as the woman became well, her husband took the opportunity to initiate divorce process against her, at which point the woman manifested the disease again to keep her husband from leaving her. At that point, the healer realized that just because she could do it, it didn't mean that she always should do it. So she totally changed her practice from, yes, I can do that because I know how to I will pray and see if I am meant to heal you. And then she was very, after that, very judicious about how she used the power. Because a master could shift all of our consciousness immediately, but he doesn't. Because it's not right. It's not in our best interest always, to have conditions shifted. Interestingly, in the Bible it says that Jesus didn't heal everyone, but he comforted everyone, which is the same in a sense as being healed. But he didn't change everybody's circumstances, but he gave everyone courage in those circumstances. The life of Saint Anthony of the Desert, who lived a few centuries after Jesus, he lived at a time when Christians were being thrown to the lions, literally, in the Roman Colosseum, and he was called from his solitude to come and help. And he had enough power that he could have made many things happen, but he mostly just walked around where the Christians were getting ready to be thrown to the lions and gave them courage. Because that was what he had to offer them. Okay? Daljeet?
Why is there a very high level of propensity for people either to live in the past or in the future?
That's a good question. Why are people so inclined to live in the past and in the future? I know. I don't know, but I have an answer. Well, the past is the subconscious mind pulling us. This is the battle of Kurukshetra between the superconscious and the subconscious. The conscious level doesn't really exist. It's the battleground between these two realities. Superconscious is trying to expand our awareness. Subconscious is trying to influence us to just not expand. Living in the past is, to a certain extent, a way of just having to put out less energy. We have this, the real delusion in the mind is that low energy is more pleasant than high energy, that the known misery is better than the unknown possibility of feeling well again. At least this is familiar. At least I know how bad this can get. So living in the past is partly just, it's familiar, and familiarity has a tremendous draw to the tamasic part of us. The people live in the future because people like to hope that things will get better. And very few people really like to actually dedicate themselves moment by moment to being dynamically forceful. The temptation of low energy, the temptation to dream of a better world, that's Maya. That's Maya just full out. Low energy is pleasant. I hope everything will get better. And when you come into the present moment, you have to do the necessary steps. In the material success course, in the course of teaching those lessons over a long period of time, it kept coming back the simple thought, which is that people think that they can visualize this great event, but they don't visualize the steps in between. They just think that they can accomplish it by seeing the end point, and just that somehow that's all they're supposed to do. And actually, many people teach you that. Visualize exactly what you want. No, you have to visualize where you need to put your foot in order to get there. You may need to know where you're going, but what your problem is, your foot is your problem. But people are not enamored of the steps. They're enamored of the dream. Just everything. You know, how many young people imagine that they will be wealthy? You know, what are you going to be? Oh, I think I'll be a sports hero. I think I'll be a movie star. I think I'll be a CEO. They don't think I'm going to work. They just think of what they're going to be, and very few arrive. It's called Maya, I think, is the answer to that. Okay? Maya is a great word. It would be oxymoronic to say I love Maya, but I do. I love the concept because it explains the inexplicable. There's just a spell cast over our minds, and we just don't think right anymore. But that dream rather than work is the hardest one. One thing about Swami Kriyananda that, among many qualities, is that he does rest when he has to. He doesn't enjoy tamasic energy. Whereas, you know, most of us enjoy tamasic energy. Let's sleep 14 hours and let's just lie in bed and watch 3 videos. You know, let's take the day off. And the day off means let's put out as low energy as we can. Swami Kriyananda doesn't enjoy low energy. He's always, I dare say, scarcely a day, I would say never a day, has gone by in which he hasn't done something creative and serviceful. You know, the day before he had open heart surgery, he's editing the preface of the book. The day after, he's editing the proofs of the book. I mean, he's barely out of anesthesia, and he has his pen in his hand, and he's working. And he actually said it brought him out of the operation much faster because he raised his energy. But you know, almost everyone would consider open heart surgery as a good reason to take a day off. But he doesn't enjoy that feeling of low energy. And neither do we. You know, we really get our greatest satisfaction from, you know, dynamic creative work. But most of us are still tempted. But we're not as tempted as the drunk who really likes just to be obliterated. and just sits there in with an obliterated consciousness, we don't enjoy that anymore, because thank God it's directional and we're on our way. Okay. Yes, Preeti. Master said, actually, if you feel that a test, that you're not really going to be able to master a challenge to your consciousness, you should run away from the situation. That's what he actually said. He said, because there's no point in standing there and being defeated, because in and of itself it will just be a defeat. And also, he said, it will leave the impression on your mind that you can't succeed. So it's better, he said, to run away from it than to go into something where you know you're going to fail. If the test is too big, he said, run away from it. Develop yourself in other ways. Now, don't run away from it in a downward way, but if you move away from it and then also commit yourself to expanding your awareness, guaranteed you'll get another chance to face it. Right. But hopefully you'll become stronger. I know in a situation where Swamiji advised a person to move away from a karma that you thought they should have faced, his answer was, you've grown as much as you can grow from this situation by facing it directly, he said. Now you need to move away and develop your consciousness in other ways so that you can then come back at it from a higher level. And he didn't. Then he said, I don't necessarily mean you'll come back at it in this lifetime. It may be the whole lifetime you have to stay away from it. You don't need to go seek it out again, in other words. He said, but it'll come back to you. Because your moving away from it is not cowardice or an attempt to be rescued or the thought that God made an error in this particular case. It's just an honest appraisal of my own ability to deal with this and the recognition that I can't. Whether that... I mean, when I ask people this, when people come to me with this question, I'll say, well, do you have any more creative ideas? You know, are you able to generate energy? And if they tell me that they don't and they can't and they aren't, that's the time. But, and sometimes, because you never, don't be afraid of that, don't be afraid of actually escaping from it. No, you'll get it, so no, it's no worry. As long as you're sincere, as long as you're deeply sincere in your desire to expand your consciousness, God will make it work out for you. And it, yeah.
It's a terrifying thought that you're putting it off to another lifetime.
No, you're not putting it off to another lifetime. You are honest, you are humbly and honestly appraising your own consciousness in the moment. And that, you know, sometimes the reason we stick with things longer than we should is because we're arrogant about our own abilities. And so that's not victory, that's arrogance. Humility, Master said, is self-honesty. It's neither self-abnegation nor self-elevation. Humility is just to say, I can't handle this. I'm just not good enough, so I need to go someplace else and get better. In a very small way, because people draw upon my time a lot, and I always tell people, don't worry, you absolutely can't impose on me. If I can't deal with it, I'll just say so. And a lot of times, you know, the phone will ring or something, and I just know I can't handle it. And I don't feel that I have to if I can't. And I'll say to my husband, I'm not here. You know, then I'll leave the house to keep it honest. Or I'll just say to the person, you know, not today. We just can't do it. But I used to not know that. And that's a small thing, you know, a life situation is different. But just self-honesty. I'm a good person, but I'm not that good. I'm not that good today. I'm not that good this incarnation. I will be, but I'm not yet. And so I need to get bigger before I can deal with this, because merely to stay and be defeated is not victory. You know, endurance, when defeat is certain, is exactly what Master said not to do, if the option is open to you. And I found that very, very interesting because it contradicts what we often might think would be true. Certainly. Anything else before? Yes, Sunny. How can we tell when a decision is right or not? Well, Jesus said, by the fruits you will know, but sometimes the fruits don't manifest immediately. You must accept the fact that you will be wrong many, many times. Last night I talking about karma. We learn from experience. And if we don't have the courage to risk and have experiences, then we never learn. Playing it safe is not a wiser course because then nothing happens, no energy flows. So we have to be just simply accept the fact that if we risk, we will crash. But if we crash, then we will have learned something and then we will pick ourselves up and start again. The way you gradually learn what is true intuition and what is not is by following it. And you follow it and you see what happens. And then you begin to recognize what it feels like when it works out and what it feels like when it doesn't work out. But a condition to make that work better is don't dogmatize your intuition, which is to say, if you've been guided to do something, don't make that the new religion. Just be humble in it. It seems like the right thing. Let's try it and see. And generally speaking, do not throw yourself off a cliff as the first step. Take a couple of steps, see what it feels like. Also, you see, stay open the whole time because your guidance may be to go north, but you may actually only need to go north for half a kilometer and then you need to turn right and go, you know, go east after that. But if you've made a dogma of my guidance says go north, then you won't notice when God tells you to go east. I have observed in myself and others that sometimes true guidance gets corrupted by ego involvement in it. So even if you're getting true guidance, don't take it to the ego. Just stay humble about it. Be willing to be wrong. When everybody tells you that you're wrong, use Sri Yukteswar's fantastic phrase, perhaps you're right, where you haven't conceded anything, but there's no argument. Perhaps you're right, we'll see. But for now, this seems right. Don't get trapped into having to be emphatic. You know, don't make everyone, this is my least favorite, God told me to do it. So if you disagree with that person, you have now disagreed with God. And that also puts you in a tough spot because you've made yourself essentially God. And then when you need to change your mind, you're in a tough spot. So just stay humble. Yeah, seems like a good idea. Let's try it. And then when it turns out really, really badly, as it will sometimes, then have a sense of humor. Well, that didn't work. Swamiji once said to me when I came a cropper in a really big way, oh, he said it so sweetly, oh, Asha, when your ego gets involved, you make terrible decisions. And I looked back and I saw where pride and a whole bunch of other things came in. And, you know, I learned. It's just what happens. Yes. It entirely depends on the circumstance. If you can physically separate yourself and their physical presence is more than you can handle and your life allows that, say hallelujah, that's a good idea. Sometimes you have to just stay right in the same house and you just have to move away internally. It's not a theoretical question. It's what has God given you, and of what God has given you, what's the best choice? And if all the choices are terrible, then you have to sort of start working with that. He never gives you a test bigger than you can handle. But to quote Mother Teresa of Calcutta, sometimes I wish he didn't have such faith in me. And I think that might be the last word. So thank you all very much. It's a joy to see you. God bless.